Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the September 1st, 2017 issue of the Week magazine. The drawing on the cover this week, it shows President Donald Trump. He's wearing a Confederate uniform. He's riding a horse, and the horse is reared up on its back leg. In his left hand, he's holding a tattered Confederate flag. And he's pointing with his right finger and looks like he's yelling at somebody. And then in the background, moving away from him, is a herd of elephants. And the title is The Lost Cause: How Trump's Defense of a White Supremacist Rally Will Affect His Presidency. And we'll go right to the main stories and how they were covered. Trump's growing fissure with his allies. What happened? President Donald Trump's political isolation deepened this week after he drew sharp criticism from military leaders, business executives, and Republican lawmakers over his response to a deadly alt-right protest in Charlottesville, Virginia. President blamed the violence in Virginia, in which swastika-waving white supremacists clashed with counter-protesters over the removal of a Confederate statue, on both sides. He said the Unite to Right rally contained some very fine people, and later denounced the growing movement to take down Confederate memorials as an attack on our culture. The CEOs on two White House business advisory councils disbanded in protest. Without mentioning Trump by name, senior leaders in four branches of the military strongly condemned the white supremacist who led the Charlottesville rally. Army Chief of Staff General Mark Milley said racism and extremism are an offense to everything we've stood for since 1775. Many Republicans also distanced themselves from the president's comments. House Speaker Paul Ryan said there could be no moral relativism when it comes to neo-Nazis. Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee, a longtime Trump defender, said the president had not shown the stability or competence needed to lead the country. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who had a profanity-laced screaming match with the president earlier this month, told aides he was horrified by Trump's comments and questioned whether Trump had sufficient understanding of government to salvage his presidency, the New York Times reported. The White House staff, meanwhile, underwent another shakeup with the firing of Chief Strategist Steve Bannon. His departure came after the self-described economic nationalist and former Breitbart News executive chairman gave an interview in which he denigrated other senior aides and admitted the president's bellicose rhetoric on North Korea was a bluff. After his dismissal, Bannon immediately rejoined Breitbart, declaring he would use the far-right site to crush his moderate West Wing enemies. "The Trump presidency that we fought for and won is over," Bannon said. What the editorial said: Trump's response to Charlottesville showed he is politically inept, morally barren, and temperamentally unfit for office, said The Economist. In failing to condemn neo-Nazis, the president flubbed the simplest of political tests. His equating of white supremacists with those protesting against them revealed the degree to which white grievance and angry, sour nostalgia is part of his worldview. Trump still had the support of 4/5 of Republican voters, But GOP leaders surely know their president is harming their country and their party. Bannon's firing is welcome news for the nation, said Chicago Tribune. His strident anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant nationalism brand of politics is divisive and repugnant. But with stories to tell and no reputation for keeping his gripes to himself, Bannon may prove more destructive to this presidency outside the West Wing than inside. That seems unlikely, said the Wall Street Journal. Bannon's allies at Breitbart have already been tearing into Chief Economic Advisor Gary Cohn and National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster for months, to no great effect. The larger question is whether the president draws the right lessons from all this. Bannon's firing suggests Trump will let Chief of Staff John Kelly impose message discipline on the White House and stop the feuding. But Trump won't get his presidency back on track until he stops attacking his allies and spewing divisive rhetoric. What the columnist said. Regardless of Bannon's departure, this remains the Breitbart presidency, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. With his shockingly conflicted response to Charlottesville, Trump spoke not as the leader of the country, nor even of one party, but as the leader of an inflamed faction. With his support eroding, his approval ratings have dropped below 40% in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, the three states that swung the election in his favor. The 45th president is slip-sliding toward a crisis of legitimacy. Pressure is growing on Trump's staff to resign in protest, said Jamie Weinstein in the Washington Examiner. But that would be a disaster. Kelly, Cohn, and McMaster are at least trying to curb the president's more dangerous instincts. If they leave, Trump will replace them with yes men who will never stand up to him. That's just a rationalization, said Brian Beutler in NewRepublic.com. If Trump truly is becoming more unhinged by the day, as some senior aides are admitting to journalists, shouldn't they try to force his removal for the good of the country? If Kelly or McMaster quit and told the world of their concerns, it would put intense pressure on the spineless GOP leadership to impeach this deranged president or force his resignation. Removing Trump from office is a terrible idea, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. Yes, he's venal, vain, and vicious, but voters knew that when they voted for him. Voiding the results of an election would be a flagrant negation of democracy, making the country truly ungovernable. So unless Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation turns up specific crimes worthy of impeachment, we're stuck with President Donald Trump until 2020. You buy the ticket, you take the ride. What's next? The next couple of months in Congress could be explosive, said Josh Dawsey in Politico.com. Already wrangling over an increase in the debt ceiling, the beginning of a tax reform package, and a possible resuscitation of health care legislation, Republicans are now bracing themselves for a fight over Trump's border wall. Democrats will never approve a budget that includes funding for the wall, and with zero Democratic votes, it may not pass. Yet Trump told rallygoers in Phoenix he's willing to shut down the government if the money isn't there. Aides said they've tried to convince the president that a government shutdown would be disastrous for him and the nation, but Trump sees not building the wall as a personal embarrassment. Controversy of the week, Confederate statues. What do they stand for? Behold, the newest battleground in our interminable culture wars, said Kyle Smith in NationalReview.com. Confederate monuments. In the wake of the violent protests in Charlottesville, Virginia, over the planned removal of a Robert E. Lee statue, leftists are baying for the destruction of all 700 or so Confederate memorials dotted across the country. Officials in Baltimore and Austin have already removed several statues under the cover of darkness, Towns and cities in such states as Kentucky, Wisconsin, and Florida have agreed to do the same. In Durham, North Carolina, an out-of-control mob tore down a monument to Confederate soldier with orgiastic glee. Personally, I have no fondness whatsoever for Lee, Stonewall Jackson, or any other rebel icons. But where will this war on symbols end? As President Trump rightly noted last week, Thomas Jefferson and George Washington were slave owners. Are statues of our founding fathers next to be torn down and erased from history? That argument is uncommonly stupid, said Paul Waldman in TheWeek.com. Washington and Jefferson are memorialized not because they owned slaves, which no one denies is a mortal stain on their legacies, but because they helped found a nation devoted to the principle that all men are created equal. Lee, in contrast, is known solely for leading a rebellion that arose to tear the country apart in order to preserve the abominable practice of slavery. Confederate monuments were erected as political statements, not historical markers, said Zach Beauchamp in Vox.com. Most of them went up from 1890 to 1920 or so, or during the 1950s and 1960s, when the South was respectively establishing Jim Crow and defending it from the Civil Rights Movement. The organizations and elected officials who put up the statues expressly said at the time that they were meant to reassure Southerners that the rebellion was a just one, and that the people who fought it were morally upright, and that white supremacy should be cherished. That's a pinched and distorted way of looking at it, said Arthur Herman in NationalReview.com. To many Southerners today, these monuments commemorate the honor, valor, and sacrifice of soldiers who fought for their region. Let's not forget President Abraham Lincoln's determination after the war to avoid retribution and heal the wounds of the nation through reconciliation. That this country can honor the heroes of both sides of such a devastating conflict is a shining example of American exceptionalism. When we tear down statues erected by previous generations, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal, we're toppling more than brass and marble. We're tearing down our nation itself. All the things, good, bad, and inadequate, that made it. Why try to hide from our imperfect past? By that standard, said Max Boot in foreignpolicy.com, Germany should have erected statues to Nazi generals who showed considerable prowess and bravery on the battlefield. Bravery cannot be separated from the cause in which it is exercised. Confederate statues and flags belong in museums where history can be recounted in an even-handed and accurate fashion. Confederate statues are part of the 150-year fiction of the lost cause, said Tony Horwitz in the Washington Post. After the Civil War, white Southerners formed a potent mythology that their rebellion was actually a defense of their sovereignty against Northern aggression. The Confederates may have lost, but they fought in a just cause. This was a lie, one the white supremacists in Charlottesville helped expose. That's the good news in all this. We may finally be nearing the end of the Confederacy's interminable afterlife. On a lighter note, it was a good week for natural preservatives after a 107-year-old piece of fruitcake was found in excellent condition in an abandoned building in Antarctica. The dessert, brought to the continent by British explorer Robert Scott in 1910, looked and smelled almost edible. It was a good week for traveling in style after Saudi monarch King Salman spent $100 million on his annual summer holiday in Morocco, a month-long trip that included more than 1,000 guests and relatives, 800 hotel rooms, and 200-plus rental cars. And it was a good week for e-stripping, after dancers at a Las Vegas strip club began accepting Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies in place of cash tips. Entertainers at Legends Room are affixed with temporary tattoos of QR codes, allowing patrons to pay digital tips on smartphones. But it was a bad week for ESPN, which was widely mocked for removing Asian American broadcaster Robert Lee from covering a University of Virginia football game due to the coincidence of his name. It was a bad week for channeling Marie Antoinette after U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin's actress wife, Louise Linton, posted a social media photo of herself with an Hermes bag and scarf on a taxpayer-funded business trip. Linton told an online critic that she and her wealthy husband paid more taxes and made more sacrifices than most people, and mocked the critic as adorably out of touch. And finally, it was a bad week for ignoring science. After President Trump defied clear warnings from experts and looked up at the sun without protective eye gear during this week's eclipse, an aide shouted, "Don't look," but the president tends not to follow advice. We're on the briefing page. Imposing sanctions. Congress recently slapped new sanctions on Russia, North Korea, and Iran. How effective are such measures? How do sanctions work? They are a means of squeezing countries or individuals economically in order to coerce them into changing their behavior. Imposed by individual governments such as the U.S. and by multinational bodies like the United Nations and European Union, sanctions take several different forms, including travel bans, asset freezes, arms embargoes, foreign aid reductions, and trade restrictions. They generally target rogue nations or individuals for destabilizing behavior, building a nuclear program, Iran, North Korea, invading a foreign country, Russia, or committing gross human rights abuses, Sudan. Countries or firms that violate these sanctions, by selling weapons to a nation under an arms embargo, for example, are fined or sometimes even sanctioned themselves. These diplomatic tools do cause significant economic damage to the targeted nation, especially to its citizens, but they rarely succeed in forcing authoritarian leaders to make lasting policy or behavior changes. All too often, says Council on Foreign Relations President Richard Haass, the economic, humanitarian, and foreign policy cost of U.S. sanctions far outweigh any benefits. How long have sanctions been used? Sanctions date to at least 432 B.C., when Athens imposed a trade embargo on neighboring Megara. Multilateral sanctions are a more recent phenomenon. The UN, which by dint of its 193-nation membership wields far more sanctioning power than any one country, enshrined the practice in its charter in 1945, but only started using them in earnest in 1990. Since then, the Security Council has imposed sanctions more than 20 times, targeting such countries as Iraq, Liberia, and the former Yugoslavia. In the 1990s, the Clinton administration also started imposing smart sanctions on individuals and companies rather than entire countries. After 9/11, the U.S. and its allies expanded their use of sanctions to disrupt the financial infrastructure of international terrorism, shutting out rogue banks from the global financial system, for example. Today, the U.S. has sanctions in place relating to more than 20 issues, including drug trafficking, terrorism, nuclear proliferation, and human rights abuses. Do sanctions actually work? Sometimes. UN and U.S. sanctions were definitely a factor in Libyan leader Muammar al-Qaddafi's decision to dismantle his weapons of mass destruction program in 2003. More recently, the multilateral sanctions imposed on Iran by the U.S., UN, and EU helped bring Tehran to the negotiating table over the country's nuclear program, albeit in conjunction with the overhanging threat of military action. But these relative successes have been the exception rather than the rule. Nicholas Burns, a senior diplomat under President George W. Bush, says that over the past 25 to 30 years, there have been very few examples where sanctions have actually succeeded. That is, forced a country to change an objectionable policy. Why is that? In large part because sanctions rarely result in real personal pain for the targeted country's leaders and top officials. The Russian economy, for example, has clearly been hurt by the sanctions imposed on the country after its 2014 annexation of Crimea. Foreign direct investment plunged from $69 billion in 2013 to just $6.8 billion in 2015. But President Vladimir Putin has continued to live like royalty and hasn't returned Crimea to Ukraine or halted his cyber warfare. Indeed, he has used his conflict with the West to boost Russian nationalism and his own popularity. Kim Jong-un is another example. In defiance of the multilateral sanctions imposed on him and his starving country, the North Korean dictator has pressed forward with his nuclear and intercontinental ballistic missile programs. In most sanctioned countries, leaders encourage the population to blame any hardships on whoever is imposing the sanctions, which can actually harden their support base. Cuba is the best example. Since the U.S. imposed a trade embargo on the island nation in 1960, the Castro regime has survived by using the U.S. as a scapegoat for its anemic economy and poor standard of living. How do countries get around sanctions? Primarily by taking their trade or assets elsewhere. When sanctions are imposed only by the U.S. or the EU and not the UN, the targeted country or individual can still deal with other nations. North Korea has even found a number of ways to circumvent UN sanctions, such as using front companies to bypass arms embargoes and exploiting a loophole to export coal to China. Besides, sanctions are only effective if they are rigorously enforced. For some of the UN's more impoverished members, selling goods to a sanctioned country can be a risk worth taking. For developed nations, enforcement often butts up against other geopolitical considerations. The U.S. has fined European banks $12 billion for laundering money for Iran, for example, but hasn't demanded a cent from Chinese institutions doing the same for North Korea. Despite the strategy's shortcomings, diplomats still consider imposing sanctions better than doing nothing. Military action is increasingly unpopular, and words don't work with hard regimes, said Sir Jeremy Greenstock, a former British ambassador to the UN. So something in between these is necessary. What else is there? And we'll read a few columns now. We'll take one from the U.S. Open carry laws will create carnage. It could have been so much worse, said David Frum, when neo-Nazis and white supremacists descended on Charlottesville, Virginia, for a Unite the Right rally 2 weeks ago, some marched in paramilitary body armor and carried semi-automatic rifles. This dangerous display of deadly weapons at a political rally, clearly meant to intimidate and silence opponents, was legal under the open carry laws that have proliferated in pro-gun states. These laws pose a serious threat to public safety. Right-wing extremists brandishing guns capable of massacring dozens of people have shown up at many events, including one who came to a 2009 President Obama appearance with a placard reading, "It's time to water the tree of liberty," a reference to Thomas Jefferson's famous description of revolutionary bloodshed. What social good is served by these open displays of vigilante firepower in city streets and at political rallies? No other democracy on earth tolerates such antics. At some future confrontation, an armed supremacist hit by a rock or bottle may decide, out of fear, anger, or wounded pride, to use his weapon on the hated enemy. Charlottesville was ugly, but a greater tragedy could have occurred, and sooner or later, it surely will. Here's one from the UK. Stop flaunting your kids on social media. Are you guilty of sharenting? Asked Jenny McCartney. That is, do you endlessly post pictures and videos of your adorable children on social media? In a recent poll, 42% of British parents declared that they happily engage in the practice. Photos of little ones on Facebook or Instagram no doubt bring joy to many people, not least far-flung relatives who rarely get to see the kids in person. The difficulty is that such sharing can become obsessive and end up invading children's privacy. A 2010 survey found that 92% of children in America had an online presence by their second birthday. The digital records of many began even before birth, with 34% of parents posting their ultrasound pictures online. There is also something rather misleading about these carefully curated images of childhood. A small child is indeed a silky-skinned marvel who will fall asleep on your arms, with hair smelling of honey, but also one who will wake you in the early hours having been sick over themselves, and quite possibly scream, "I hate you," as you clean them up. Why only share the good moments? Why, more to the point, waste time recording parenthood online in a vain effort to capture the moment when you should simply be experiencing it? And this from China. Hong Kong's opposition has lost the plot. Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement once provided real opposition to the Beijing-approved sycophants and rubber stampers who fill our city's legislature, said Yandin Latu. Not anymore. These activists have been slowly drifting into irrelevance and have now plumbed new depths of political buffoonery with the farce known as Staplegate. Last week, Democratic Party member Howard Lam Tsikin shocked the city with claims that he'd been kidnapped and tortured by Chinese government agents who punched staples into his legs and then dumped him on a bench. It was punishment, he said, for trying to contact the wife of the late Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo. The Democratic Party paraded Lam in front of cameras, staples and all, and proclaimed the incident a death knell for the city's autonomy from the mainland. But under investigation, Lam's story crumbled. He was arrested for misleading the police, leaving the party's credibility in tatters. This is only the latest example of extreme behavior from the opposition. Over the past year, six pro-democracy lawmakers have been expelled from the legislature for deliberately mangling their oaths of office to avoid swearing loyalty to China. That stunt deprived their allies of the votes required to veto the legislature's pro-Beijing camp. We desperately need a credible and competent opposition, not this hysterical bunch. ¶¶ time for The Last Word, our in-depth article. Very topical this week. The title is The Making of a White Supremacist. The alt-right nationalists who converged on Charlottesville were proud of their racism, said journalist Terrence McCoy, and thrilled to find others who share their feelings of resentment and victimhood. For all that he did in Charlottesville, Virginia, chanting anti-Semitic slogans, carrying a torch through Emancipation Park, he wasn't even aware that the alt-right existed 1 year ago. It wasn't until Hillary Clinton condemned the movement in a campaign speech last August that he first learned of it. And from there, the radicalization of William Fears, 29, moved quickly. He heard that one of its spokesmen, Richard Spencer, who coined the name alt-right, was speaking at Texas A&M University in December, so he drove the 2 hours to hear him speak. There, he met people who looked like him, people he never would have associated with white nationalism, men wearing suits, not swastikas, and it made him want to be a part of something. Then Fears was going to other rallies across Texas, and local websites were calling him one of Houston's most outspoken neo-Nazis. And he was seeing alt-right memes of Adolf Hitler that at first he thought foolish. People are going to hate us, but soon learned to enjoy. It's been about a year, he said, but my evolution has been faster and faster. The Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, which ended with dozens injured, a woman struck dead by a car, and a president again engulfed in scandal, and another national bout of soul-searching over race in America, was a collection of virtually every kind of white nationalist the country has ever known. There were members of the Ku Klux Klan, skinheads, and neo-Nazis, but it was this group, the group of William Fears, that was not so familiar. The torch-lit images of the march through Emancipation Park revealed scores like him. Clean-cut, unashamed, and young, they almost looked as though they were students of the university they marched through. Who were they? What in their relatively short lives had so aggrieved them that they felt compelled to drive across the country for a rally? How does this happen? The answer is complicated and unique to each person, but there are nonetheless similarities. According to lengthy interviews with six young men ages 21 to 35 who traveled hundreds of miles to Charlottesville to the rally, for these men, it was far from a lark. It was the culmination of something that took months for some, years for others. There were plot points along this trajectory, each emboldening them more and more until they were on the streets of Charlottesville, ready to unshackle themselves from the anonymity of online avatars and show the world their faces. From New Orleans, one man journeyed 965 miles. Another arrived from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, 247 miles. Another drove all night, more than 20 hours in all, from Austin, 1,404 miles. One traveled from Dayton, Ohio, 442 miles. The road to Charlottesville, 540 miles away from his home in Paoli, Indiana, began decades ago for Matthew Parrott, who at 35 calls himself the first alt-righter, referencing to a small and decentralized movement of extreme conservatives, many of whom profess white supremacist and anti-Semitic beliefs, and seek a white-only ethnostate. Parrott was socially awkward and had been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome at 15, so his family pulled their money and got him a computer with access to the internet, a rarity in his neighborhood of mobile homes. In chat rooms, he developed a taste for intellectual combat, always taking the contrarian side, obsessing over how to dismantle progressive arguments until, as he puts it, he ended up self-radicalizing. That radicalization was rooted, he said, in his own feelings of alienation, which intensified when he went to Indiana University and confronted an elite he soon came to disdain. They made fun of my accent and my overbite and they called me white trash and hillbilly, Parrott said. I was never able to identify with a single person. He dropped out after his first semester, and his disillusionment festered until, at 23, he went to the National Conference of the Council of Conservative Citizens, a white nationalist organization based in St. Louis. He considers this moment when comparing what white nationalism once was and what it has become. I was the youngest one in the room, he said. Old men asked me, whose grandson are you? They were baffled, and now those guys are too frail to understand what's going on. What was going on? The same alienation and purposelessness that once defined his life has come to characterize that of so many others. An economy capsized, a job market contracted, a student loan crisis erupted, and feelings of resentment and victimization took hold among some members of Parrott's generation. This is not some hypothetical thing, said Parrott, who soon established the white nationalist traditionalist youth network and started recruiting. This is, I'm stuck working at McDonald's, where there are no factory jobs, and the boomer economy is gone, and we have got this humiliating, degrading service economy. They feel the ladder has been kicked away from them. And who is to blame for all this? Those who joined the alt-right did not view impersonal economic factors or their own failings as culprits. In some respects, it's not that different from Islamist extremist Ryan Lentz of the Southern Poverty Law Center said. A similar set of conditions, disaffected young men, few jobs for them, and a radical ideology promising answers has fueled recruitment for the alt-right. These young men, Lentz said, were told they were sold a raw bill of goods. The government is working against them and doesn't give a blank about white people. And they were told this during a period when the first African-American president was in the White House. There came a moment for every young man interviewed when they felt whites, and particularly white men, had become subject to discrimination, a perception that formed the foundation of their new identities. Peyton Ober, 21, of Metairie, Louisiana, perceived it after graduating from high school when he was looking for a job. Where I live, go to any McDonald's or Walmart, and most of the employees are black, said Ober, who is unemployed, and I could put in 500 applications and receive one call. Every time I walked into Walmart, there were no white people. And how come they are getting hired and I can't? White privilege, he said. I'm still waiting on my privilege. For Tony Hoveter, 29, of Dayton, it came after he dropped out of college and was touring as a drummer in a metal band, and he passed through the small towns of the Rust Belt in Appalachia. He started thinking that so much of the national narrative focuses on the plight of the poor urban minorities, but here was poverty as desperate as any he had seen, and yet no one was talking about poor whites. You see how a complete system failed a group of people and didn't take any responsibility for it and has done nothing to help, he said. For Connor Perrin, 29, of Austin, who grew up upper middle class, it was during college when he felt campus liberals were ostracizing his fraternity because it was white. If only people would stop attacking us, he said. I can't say anything just because I'm white. I can't talk about race, and I can't talk about the Jews because I'll be called an anti-Semite, and I can't say I want to date my own race. For Eric Starr, 31, of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, who has been convicted of disorderly conduct for fighting and possession with intent to manufacture or deliver, it was growing up white in a poor black neighborhood. I got bullied, and I got made fun of, and I got beat up, he said. Cracker, whitey, white boy. And for William Fears, who has been convicted of criminal trespass, aggravated kidnapping, and possession of a controlled substance, it happened while he was incarcerated. I don't think any race experiences racism in the modern world the way that white people do in jail, he said. In jail, whites come last. From these disparate geographies, social classes and upbringings, rich and poor, rural and urban, educated and not, they converged on a single place in August, Charlottesville, with a shared belief that they, white men, are the true victims of today's America. I wanted to be in the fight, Perrin said. I needed to be more aggressive, Parrott said. We never fight for anything, Fears said. The violence that they would mete out and receive on the streets of a picturesque college town was the most pivotal moment to date in the evolution of the alt-right, the men interviewed believe. The alt-right has always been a diffuse movement, but it has also been intensely communal. People make and share memes that glorify President Trump and make jokes of Hitler and the Holocaust. They discuss events on 4chan, Reddit, and Discord. They get to know one another despite a distance of hundreds of miles. They learn not to fear being called a racist or a Nazi. And in fact, some found it liberating, even addicting, as Parrott said. But Charlottesville represented an opportunity to further transcend what they called confining social taboos. Many came prepared for violence, like Fears, who was wearing a blue business suit, a helmet, a gas mask, and goggles. He rode a van with a group of other alt-right members and described it as being transported into a war zone. Bottles burst against the van's windows, he recalled. People hit the van. It stopped before Emancipation Park, and everyone started yelling to get out as quickly as possible. Gripping a flag like a weapon, Fear strode to the front and melted into the melee. He threw punches. He took punches. He felt disgust. Someone hit me in the head with a stick, he said, and it split my goggles off. Little savages, Star said of the counter-protesters. Subhuman, Perrin said. Neither the day's events leading to the car crash that killed Heather Heyer and injured 19 others, nor the condemnations from politicians and people across the country that followed, have convinced those interviewed that their beliefs are wrong. For some, it only confirmed their sense of victimhood. They felt silenced and censored, deprived of their rights. They felt as if the death of Heyer had changed everything, and that uncontrollable forces had been unleashed. It was like a war, and some people died, and it was an eerie feeling, Fear said. Things are life and death now, and if you're involved in this movement, you have to be willing to die for it now. And that was the first time that happened. Soon after the rally, Fears started the long trip home to Houston, where he is a construction worker. He talked to his family, who pretty much agree with me. He tried to calm down his little brother, who was shaken up by it. He thought about what would happen if he died. If I'm killed, that's fine, he said. Maybe I'll be a martyr or something, or remembered. He knows there will be another Black Lives Matter event soon, and he has plans to go. I'll take a megaphone and see what they have to say, he said. I would like there not to be more violence, but it might be inevitable. So let's get this out of the way. If there's going to be a violent race war, maybe we should do it. Maybe we should escalate it. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. I'm going to read two obituaries for you this week. Ironically, both comedians. The first, the madcap comic who delighted millions, but not critics. Jerry Lewis, 1926 to 2017. Jerry Lewis was loved and loathed in equal measure. The comedian and filmmaker's banana peel, slapstick, and manic man-child persona were seen by moviegoers as either comic gold, French intellectuals considered him a genius, or excruciatingly unfunny. His comic partnership with Loesch crooner Dean Martin in the 1940s and 50s was wildly successful. But when he branched out as a movie auteur, blazing a trail for Woody Allen and Mel Brooks, his films were often branded pretentiously self-indulgent. Lewis' work as an actor and director was eventually eclipsed by his 44-year run as host of the Muscular Dystrophy Association's annual telethon. But even his good deeds weren't without controversy. Throughout, his arrogance was legendary. "I don't give a blank if people think I have a fantastic ego," Lewis said in 2000. "I worked my heart out, and you know what? I'm as good as they get." Born in Newark, New Jersey, Lewis was the only child of vaudeville entertainers Danny and Ray Levitch, said the New York Times. Foisted on relatives while his parents were on the road, young Lewis felt a desperate need for attention and affection. He found it in front of an audience. When he was six, his parents brought him on stage at a Jewish resort hotel to sing, "Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?" Lewis quit high school just before his 16th birthday and honed a lip-sync act in which he mugged outrageously to operatic and pop tunes played on a phonograph, said the Washington Post. At a Manhattan club in the mid-40s, Lewis shared the bill with a suave, sleepy-eyed vocalist named Dean Martin. Teaming up, the pair developed a unique comedic template. "I conduct the three-piece band with one of my shoes, burn their music, jump off stage, run around tables, sit with the customers and spill things while Dean keeps singing," Lewis explained, noting the act was essentially a handsome man and a monkey. Within 2 years, Martin and Lewis were the hottest comedy act in show business, said the Los Angeles Times. On TV from 1950 to 1955, the pair regularly hosted the Colgate Comedy Hour, and Lewis' signature lines, I like it, and lady, became national catchphrases. They made 16 films together, from My Friend Irma in 1949, to Hollywood or Bust in 1956. But Martin wearied of playing the stooge. Tensions bubbled over and the team dissolved in 1956 after a gig at New York's Copacabana. Lewis made his starring directing debut with 1960's The Bellboy and enjoyed a string of hits, most notably 1963's The Nutty Professor, a variation on Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, in which the scientist's dark alter ego was a smooth lounge singer reminiscent of Martin. Dismissed by American critics, Lewis was revered in France, which awarded him the Order of Arts and Letters, the country's highest cultural honor. By the late 1960s, Lewis seemed to be losing his way, said The Guardian, and in an edgier era, his shrill style fell out of fashion. He found a new form of celebrity with the Labor Day Muscular Dystrophy Telethon, which he first hosted in 1966, and always concluded with an emotional rendition of You'll Never Walk Alone. Some disability rights groups claimed he exploited the disabled children who appeared on the show for his own glory. Lewis simply pointed to the nearly $1.5 billion he raised through the telethons. In 1982, he made his big screen comeback with an acclaimed serious turn as a kidnapped talk show host in Martin Scorsese's The King of Comedy. Overcoming illness and addiction to painkillers, Lewis continued acting until last year and never mellowed. Honored for career achievement by the Los Angeles Film Critics Association in 2005, he said from the podium, "I am delighted to be the recipient of this award. What took you so blank, blank long?" And the second obituary, the groundbreaking comedian who became a civil rights voice, Dick Gregory, 1932 to 2017. In the early 1960s, Dick Gregory became the first black stand-up comedian to smash through the color barrier. Perched on a stool, cigarette in hand, he won over white audiences and nightclubs with coolly delivered but scathing observations about America's racial divide. "A Southern liberal," he once said, "that's a guy that'll lynch you from a low tree." He insisted segregation wasn't all bad. "Have you ever heard of a collision where the people in the back of the bus got hurt?" And he often recited the story of a white waitress in the South who told him her restaurant didn't serve colored people. "I said, that's all right. I don't eat colored people. Bring me a whole fried chicken." But Gregory, who would become a leading figure in the civil rights movement, never pigeonholed himself as a black comedian. "I've got to be a colored funny man," he said, "not a funny colored man." Born in St. Louis and raised in poverty by a single mother, Gregory used humor as a defense against the neighborhood bullies, said the HollywoodReporter.com. He began experimenting with comedy routines after being drafted into the U.S. Army during college, and later moved to Chicago to launch his career. Gregory's big break came in 1961 when he stood in for Irwin Corey at the city's Playboy Club. "When I started, a black comic couldn't work a white nightclub," he said. "You could sing, you could dance, but you couldn't stand flat-footed and talk. Then the system would know how brilliant black folks was." The crowd at that first gig, mostly white executives from the South, loved him. Gregory's career quickly snowballed, said the Los Angeles Times. He performed at the hippest clubs across the country, appeared on Jack Parr's Tonight Show, and put out several best-selling comedy albums. In 1964, Gregory released an autobiography titled Nigger. "Wherever you are," he wrote to his late mother in the foreword, "if you hear the word nigger again, remember they are advertising my book." As his fame grew, Gregory shifted his focus to frontline activism, said the Washington Post. A confidant of Martin Luther King Jr. and other civil rights leaders, he marched in Selma, Alabama, was jailed and beaten by police in Birmingham, Alabama, was shot in the leg during the 1965 Watts riots in Los Angeles, and protested de facto school segregation in Chicago by running for mayor. He later took part in fasts for peace during the Vietnam War and the Iran hostage crisis, and enjoyed a brief but lucrative career in the 1980s as a diet guru. Gregory returned to stand-up in the 1990s, but always put activism first. "Once the movement is in you, it's there," he said. "It never leaves." And as we often do, we'll finish out the hour on the Talking Points page. The eclipse, a nation briefly united in awe. "For one brief moment, day became night," said William Wan in WashingtonPost.com. Millions of Americans clutching their solar glasses, cameras, and telescopes gazed into the sky as one to watch the sun be replaced by a black circle ringed on all sides with gleaming white fire. Darkness descended, a chill went through the air, and startled birds darted in every direction. It was the celestial event of the century. The great American eclipse of August 21st, 2017, when, for a few fleeting moments, the moon blotted out the sun across 14 states in the first coast-to-coast total eclipse since 1918. In Oregon, where the eclipse made landfall, said Henry Fountain in the New York Times, an elderly couple pulled up on Interstate 5, clutched each other, and beamed and laughed as totality began. As the eclipse swept through Idaho, Wyoming, and across the marshes of South Carolina, onlookers wept, laughed uncontrollably, and stared dumbfounded at the midday darkness. "I'm in awe," said one eclipse watcher. "Magical," said another. All too soon it was over, said Laura King and Matt Pierce in LATimes.com. But for two or three brief minutes, the cosmic spectacle awakened a sense of childlike wonder in young and old. The event was the most watched eclipse in history, with 12 million people living in the path of totality and hundreds of thousands of others choking the nation's highways to stake out prime viewing spots. Across cultures, an eclipse has been seen as a potent of doom, said Bloomberg.com in an editorial. But for an America blighted by division, rage, and resentment, this eclipse represented a welcome unifier, a communal act free of politics, just what the U.S. needs. I can vouch for that, said Brian Resnick in Vox.com. As adults, we grow cynical and numb to life's mysteries. But from my spot in South Carolina, when the shadow fully took over the sun, the crickets chirped, Venus appeared bright in the sky next to the sun, and I lay down before a black, black disk that was surrounded by the most angelic white light I've ever seen. The awe-inspiring spectacle made the world, the universe, feel big again. As one eclipse chaser put it, a total eclipse reminds you of your insignificance. Frankly, I think we all could use that. And just time for a short note or two. For the first time, more Americans are being cremated than having traditional burials, according to the National Funeral Directors Association. The cremation rate in 2016 achieved a milestone, edging past 50% to 50.2%, up from 48.5% in 2015. And 45 years after Elvis Presley's death, his Graceland home in Memphis remains the second most visited house in the U.S. after the White House. More than 600,000 people visit Graceland every year. And a quick quote from Dick Gregory. I never learned hate at home or shame. I had to go to school for that. We hope we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.